Oregon Health Plan. Senator Minas will be along shortly and ask us to go ahead and start as a subcommittee. And we will have testimony regarding the FIAT program, Rocky King.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farioli.
I'm not sure Mr. King is the appropriate person to ask, but today I heard for the first time that the Oregon Health Plan waiver is on hold in Washington, D.C. I wondered if Mr. King had any information relative to that.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I do not believe, I've had no discussions about that. I do know that it is in Washington, D.C. It is almost all the way through CMS that Tom Scully, who I believe is the head of CMS, has been having some discussions with the governor over the last month, but I don't know anything about it being on hold.
Thank you.
Are you done?
I'm done.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment that in the cafeteria earlier today, I said, Jesus, nobody in the committee room. He says, I've already testified. You missed it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for first the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the state high-risk health insurance pool for people turned down for health insurance in the private sector who have no alternative but to come to the pool for medical coverage. And I'm also the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which administers the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is referred to generally as FIAP. I have before you a outline that I can follow and will try to get through rather quickly to leave time for a number of questions that I'm sure that you may have. On the second page, I will specifically talk about OHP2 and the waiver and its impact on the FIAP program so that you'll have a good understanding of why we at FIAP are very supportive, hopefully, that the waiver will come through, at least from the FIAP perspective. First of all, you need to know that 1995-96, when we were really expanding health care on the commercial side, there was a committee that Vicki Gates headed up, made up of labor and business representatives, to look at how we could use the private health care system to expand coverage to those Oregonians who we refer to really as the working poor. And out of that committee came a one-sentence legislative concept, and it basically said, go subsidize folks that are working so they can buy either employer-based or individual coverage health care. And in 1997, Representative Patty Milne, and I think it was Chuck Carpenter, Representative Carpenter from the 7th District, who formed a work group, again, made up of AOI, NFIB, labor, and consumer representatives, and really started working on the components of House Bill 2894, which was designed, again, to try to get to those folks who didn't qualify for Medicaid but were out there paying taxes to support those that were getting Medicaid and getting Medicare, and how could we help them when they couldn't afford their share of the health care premiums, either through their employer or the individual market, and thus were going uninsured. So in 97, through bipartisan, I think, support, and with support of the governor, House Bill 2894 passed. And 10 months later, or almost 9 months later, we implemented FIAP throughout the state. Key points about the program. It's state funds only. In every biennium we go through, with starting with what the governor requests, going down to zero and settling someplace in between, because state general fund programs are hard to maintain, as we all know. Secondly, it's private sector based. We use the private sector market that's out there, the Blue Crosses, the ODSs, the Kaisers, the Pacific Source, the QualMeds. And secondly, we use the provider systems that contract with those insurance carriers, whether it's group or individual market. Third, and a key thing that was established in 1997 when we started this, is the program is capped. They said, here's the dollars, Rocky, X amount of dollars, don't spend a penny more. And it isn't where we can control the intake simply by closing down the application program. We use a reservation system we'll talk about, so that we're able to control the number of people into the program and thus live within whatever the appropriated dollars from the legislature are given to us. And finally, it's targeted to those working Oregonians yet unable to afford health insurance for either themselves or their dependents. program principles, and I think a lot of people don't like to read these, but I'm going to read them because when we sat down with Patty Milne and really talked about this with the different legislative committees, we wanted to make sure that we had agreement on the principles by which we would design the program. Because although we had a legislative piece, we needed to know what it was we were trying to do. First of all, we wanted to foster independence and self-reliance. We were really looking at a bridge, people coming off the public sector side and finding out what it's like to pay premiums, pay co-pays, pay deductibles, and really move into what the other 2.2 million Oregonians are doing that are currently insured. We want to encourage comparison shopping and consumer choice. And what we mean by that is we wanted to begin giving them the knowledge to make good decisions about their health care and their health care dollars. Respect confidentiality and maintain personal dignity. One of the things about FEOP is it's blind to the provider. It's blind to the carrier very often. It's blind to the employer, other than a few forms that need to be filled out. The hardest one that we've had to deal with is assuring administrative simplicity and efficiency. Originally, we wanted to get to that goal of the one-page application. The reality is you have a 7 or 8 page application. And you have to do that simply to ensure that those people that are getting into the program provide you with the information to do a good job in determining eligibility. It's not an entitlement. People don't have a right to this. They have to get in line. We have 4,000 slots. We have 20,000 on a waiting list. Responds to real-life issues of maintaining a household budget. We had to understand that they were going to make their own co-pays and deductibles, and in many cases, substantial co-pays and deductibles based on their employer plan. So we had to set the subsidy level high enough so that it would encourage people to come into the program. Had to be the people who were uninsured. There's some inequity about this program. If you're insured, you're not eligible. If you're uninsured, you're eligible. The reality is we wanted to get as many people under the tent as we could with this program when we first established it. You can't enroll the adults without enrolling the children. We wanted to build on the current strength of the private health care system, where, again, we have over 2.2 million people currently insured. And we wanted to promote some equity in health care financing. Again, realizing these folks pay taxes to support Medicaid, Medicare, employers who deduct it from their business expense, but yet can't afford health care themselves. And we thought this was an equitable way to do it. Eligibility is really simple. You have to be a resident of Oregon. We require photo IDs. Must be a U.S. citizen or legal non-citizen, and that will change, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Must have been without health insurance for the previous 6 months. Must have investments and savings of less than $10,000. One of the decisions that was made in these work groups with the legislative groups that Representative Milne put together is we really wanted to support people learning how to save money. And as they move up the economic ladder, rather than depleting all their assets down to $1,000 or $2,000, to be able to hopefully start putting some dollars aside. The reality is the average is probably $2,000 in liquid assets of those that are currently enrolled. Again, all children had to that were eligible be in health insurance before the family could receive a subsidy. People eligible or receiving Medicare cannot use the subsidy. And one departure from Medicaid is we offered a 12-month eligibility as opposed to a 6-month eligibility. The idea there is let's get them in. These are folks that are working. Let's commit themselves to a period of time where they didn't have to worry about health care. They could worry about keeping their jobs and promoting themselves as opposed to earning an extra 50 cents an hour and getting knocked off the health plan. Those are kind of the key eligibility. Two options under FEOP. The first is group market. Basically, we say if you have group coverage available to you and there's any contribution on the part of the employer, then you have to take that group plan. There are some exceptions when you can't go to somebody that makes $7 an hour and say a $2,000 deductible plan makes sense to you. So we do allow some choices if the plan is I'll call it a ridiculous plan. Any group plan though offered by an employer. We find one of the funny things about FEOP is we have a lot of people enrolled whose kids are eligible for CHIP Medicaid who enroll their children into FEOP, pay a premium, pay co-pays and deductibles for a couple of reasons. One, they like the provider system. They carry a Blue Cross or an ODS card, and that gets them to a better provider system in terms of access. secondly, they like to keep the families together. So we have found that there's a lot of folks that come into our program that could opt out for the public side, but end up coming in. And we find this especially true in the group market with parents putting their children there as opposed to CHIP. If you don't have a group market available to you, then you can go to the individual market. We have certified every major individual market carrier, I think, in the state, except perhaps one. And you can choose any plan that's offered by those carriers. Dental is generally not included in any of the individual market plans. Dental is generally not included in small employer plans. If it is offered in a part of the package that all the employees get, we will subsidize it. If it's not, then they don't receive dental subsidy through the FEOP program.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
One of the principles of FEOP was that the concern was that the program would easily fill up with people from the I-5 corridor where the uninsured rates are lower, and that people in the more rural areas, especially in eastern Oregon, would not be enrolled in equal numbers proportionally. And I'm looking at these health plans, and I'm wondering where these health plans are based. I know that Kaiser Permanente tends to be based in the Portland metropolitan area. Where are the other ones?
We don't have the list. Is the list of carriers is, Kelly, do you have the... I want to...
On page 13 of the agency overview.
If you go to page 23, by the way, that'll show you the distribution by major area in Oregon, the basic enrollment. ODS is statewide. Pacific Care is primarily, I think, I'm going to ask for some help here, the I-5 corridor, north to south, HealthNet, and many of these are in portions of eastern Oregon, and especially the Bend and Pendleton area. Regents, again, is statewide. OMIP is statewide. I think almost every case you have at least two options, except if you get into the Burns of the world. You may have Regents as your only option. But again, our options are basically the same as those who can afford health insurance and purchase it in the regular private sector market. They're not special plans. They're the same plans offered to all citizens.
Senator Rocky, just another response I wasn't quite sure. Do you believe that somehow or other there's any kind of bias in the program so that it doesn't serve people in rural Oregon as well as it does in urban Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, I don't think there's a bias. It's really dependent on the agents and the kind of community action, you know, agencies and their local communities. Let me tell a little bit about when we first rolled out the program. And one thing that's really important, we have not marketed this program since 1998. When we reached every biennium, we've seen the program cut. We had about 15,000 initially approved, then 7,500, then 5,500, and now it's about 4,500 that we have approved for. And we started the biennium about 6,000, so we've had to come down below that. So we haven't marketed this program. When we did market it, there were pockets uninsured rate, or people where the uninsured rate is higher, primarily eastern Oregon, some of the southern Oregon areas, especially along the coast. There were some portions of Portland, Woodburn area with some of the ethnic minority groups. We actually did the training and rollout in those communities before we did the major metropolitan areas in the I-5 corridor, simply because we didn't want the reservation list to fill up with everybody that lived in Salem or everybody that lived in, you know, in Portland. So we were very careful about that, and if and upon approval of that waiver, if it's signed and everybody gets going on it, our marketing again will be focused on eastern Oregon, southern Oregon, and some of those pockets for the first couple months, just so we can balance off the entry into the program by those groups.
Rocky, can you help me understand the relationship with this PF program that is said earlier, entirely state-funded, and the waivers with the Medicaid waiver?
Sure, Mr. Chair, if I go to the second page, about halfway down, it says waiver implications. First of all, 25, Hospital 2519 directed DHS to go get federal funds, and it really had two purposes. One was the public side, to provide all the things that Gene and Lynn have been talking about. The other piece, though, was to try to get federal funding for the FEOP program. And really, our goals were to implement October 1st, to market and do outreach ramp up beginning October 2002, to its private sector base. We would get federal matching funds, both Title 19 and Title 21, the Medicaid and SCHIP funds. We would be able to, with current state funding, and I think there's a small amount, I have to look at Becky, $5 million from OHC? No. For this buy-in, it's zero. But just with the state dollars we have available, we would be able to expand by approximately 25,000 individuals.
Okay, so if I understand this correctly, then currently it's all state funded,
all state
no federal money. The waiver, as it is currently in its present form, waiting for approval, that would allow access to several pots of federal money, and therein is where the expansion lies.
That's correct.
Okay. And what's the total dollar amount that you're expecting from federal funds in terms of
federal funds?
This finding.
$14 or $15 million this biennium, and that grows to about $70 million next biennium.
All right. Okay.
The Title 21 match is about $72.28 million.
Money just for this purpose? Extension of FEOP? Would it
just
be there for anything else?
Just for the FEOP.
Would not be there for anything else.
Not the public side, just the FEOP side. The other thing that House Bill 2519 does is it puts an emphasis on group coverage. And basically what it says is 50% of the state resources would be used to expand group coverage, the other 50% individual coverage. And if you look at the cost of FEOP up above, which is average subsidy per individual, you can see leveraging the employer dollars, which is about $80 per month per enrollee, is a significant advantage over the individual or the OMIP markets, where your average is anywhere from $172 for the individual to about $275 per month per enrollee for OMIP. OMIP is a little different because you're talking about an average age of 52, 53, 70% female. It's a very much older population than regular individual market, where your average age is probably about 30 to 35. But leveraging then those employer dollars and their contributions allows us to serve out of that 25,000 about 19,000 people in the individual in the group market, and 5,000 to 6,000 in the individual market. So really, and the support that came was really helping small businesses provide the dependent and in some cases employee coverage through the workplace, which has been the most difficult thing to maintain over the last 2 years during the recession. One change from what we currently operate. Currently, we say any group plan, but the House Bill 2519 established that the Insurance Pool Governing Board had to establish a benchmark benefit plan. That is, no plan that doesn't have these benefits or higher can be subsidized. The benchmark benefit plan is a pretty standard plan. It basically says the most common offered in the small group market. It's a $500 deductible plan, 80-20 copay. It's very similar to just what basically 80 to 90% of the people in the state have. They either have that or something a little better. We are going to be reviewing that benchmark because what's occurred in the economy in the last year or the last 6 or 7 months since we established it has been increased copays and deductibles, and we're going to adjust that benchmark to reflect what's happening out there in the private sector and especially in the small business community. The waiver also allows us to expand up to 185% of poverty. We're currently at 170. Our statute allows us to go to 200, but the board made an internal decision always to stay at 170% simply to keep in line with the CHIP program run by Medicaid. Other eligibility changes, we will no longer serve the legal non-citizen. That will be changed to the qualified legal non-citizen per Medicaid. and has a certain subset of those that come before a certain date. But now we won't just do legal non-citizens. There's a stronger monitoring and evaluation component required by the federal government. We're working on that now, and we hope to develop baselines of what's going on in the employer-based markets around benefits, cost sharing, what industries, what parts of the state, so that we have a good baseline to look at what kind of impact we have on the employer-based market over the next couple years. There is a maintenance effort in the waivers at about $9.6 million based on state fiscal year 2002 that's tied to FEOP. And finally, there's one legislative concept, assuming that the waiver goes through and it's passed and signed and we implement, and that is the OMIP assessment. OMIP started in 1990. In our first year, I think we assessed for $1 million. This assessment is going to be our last assessment. I think year is going to be about 30 to 35 million. About 20 to 25 percent, actually 30 percent now, of the people that go into the individual market are usually declined coverage and end up in the high-risk pool. If we expand by 5 or 6,000, you're talking an additional 1,500 to 2,000 people that could end up in the high-risk pool and thus drive insurer assessments higher. So we're trying we have a legislative concept which would allow us to use more federal dollars in a way of offsetting some of the assessment on the insurers and thus hopefully lessen some of the impact on everybody who buys insurance, because all of us who pay for our own premiums end up paying a portion of that premium to OMIP through that assessment process. That'll be a key thing that we'll present during this next legislative session. So in summary, Chair, in terms of the waiver implications, in order to use the federal funds, we've got to get a waiver. Without the waiver, we're state-funded only, and we all know that in today's environment, that doesn't make a lot of sense. We can expand from what we basically have approved, about 4,500 people, by about 25,000 this biennium. It'll be capped. It's not an entitlement. It supports the small business community, and that about three-quarters of that expansion is going to be in the small and large business areas. The eligibility will basically remain about the same other than the legal non-citizen. Some of the questions you talked about accountability and sustainability, they've been fun to listen to. Sometimes I want to be on that side, sometimes I don't mind being on this side. First of all, the program's capped. You tell me I can spend a dollar, that's all I can spend. I can tell you that other than going to the e-board to get some resources to expand the program, we haven't been to the e-board because of overspending or anything like that since we operated and implemented all these programs through Insurance Pool Governing Board, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, in 1990. You give us a dollar, that's our authority. You give us 50 cents, that's our authority. We have to manage that program to those dollars. We're subject to all the state accounting and fiscal systems that all other state agencies are. We have an internal audit unit, and we audit two things. One is to audit the eligibility workers. They do a determination of eligibility, and we do a lot of them, but it's really hard to compare us in OMAP and what they do in Medicaid, because our numbers aren't 480,000. Our numbers are 5 or 6 or 7,000. So we have some luxury in terms of being able to do that. But we audit our workers. And all of our supervisors are what we call working supervisors. They work the files with the particular eligibility folks. Secondly, we also audit those that apply to the program. We require tax returns, for example. If there's a line on there that says there's a little money coming in that doesn't show up on a wage statement, we go back and look at that. And we require additional information. So when you talk about the auditing, you really need to focus on two folks. You got your clients, and you need to make sure that the information they're giving to you is correct. You know, you catch them changing a wage stub from an employer. And by the way, eligibility workers, it's an art. It's not a science. It's being able to read between the lines in these applications and say, something doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. And that brings it up to the top that really has them get on the phone and get additional information. We can audit both the clients and the eligibility workers to make sure they're doing the right job. We're subject to the Secretary of State audit. Senator Farrioli, we have an audit that we have done, and I'd be happy to share it with you. We implemented this program in record time. It was like 7 or 8 months after the legislation was signed. And about a year after that, we went to John Latimer, who was the Secretary of State, and said, help. We just did something that nobody's done. We need a risk management audit. Come in and tell us where we're weak, where we're strong. And they did. And they told us contracting wasn't very good, so we needed to change some of that language. They told us that some of our fiscal controls weren't in place. We were losing some interest because we were paying people too early. Hold up until the money's due, leave the money in there and get some state interest. And I have a copy of that audit report, and we'll provide that to you. Through that process of doing that audit, we also determined to bring the system, the administration of the program in-house. We did do it through a third-party administrative agreement. And we reached mutual decision with Oregon Dental Service and Best Choice Administrators to terminate our contract with them. We tried a lot of different models, a way to find efficiencies, but we just found that our costs could do it less than what they could at that point and brought it in-house. That does not mean at some point in the future we don't decide to go back out with that. We haven't ever ruled that out. We've always said that bringing it in-house was really a concept as opposed to a final decision. But our administrative costs projected for the next biennium are 7.5%. I think it's 7.5. 7.49. Assuming that even if you bid it out, you're still going to have a 2 or 3% internal cost for all the auditing and all the things that state agencies do. So let's say that you have 5% that you're giving the third-party administrator. Saving 1% is not a lot of dough. You can't squeeze a 20% savings out of our program by saving 1% out of a TPA. So it's got to be based on customer service. It's got to be based on other efficiencies just other than the dollar if we make the decision to release and do another third-party administrator. The sustainability, that to me is a simple question. We're state-funded. Will be in the next governor's budget. State general fund.
Question, Rocky,
so Rocky, I appreciate the management of your agency and the years that I've been around. I've heard nothing but good. I've seen you testify before. I appreciate your frankness and ability to convey to us what you're doing. You did go kind of fast over the high-risk pool, and could you just expand a little bit? It's my understanding that the OMIP assessment is an assessment on private insurance industry, and they pay to subsidize this program. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And then one other thing I wanted to clarify is that earlier this year, sitting on the Leadership Commission on Healthcare Costs and Trends, you testified. And could you just share with this committee a little bit your comments? If I remember correctly, you were talking about the Oregon Health Plan and some survey you did or some information you arrived at about the Oregon Health Plan being far richer than, say, small employers are able to provide. I may have misinterpreted exactly your statement, but if you can clarify what I'm trying to get at, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farner, I don't remember the last piece. Let me talk to you about the benefits. Generally, the benefits contained in the small group individual market are not as equal to the OHP. But you have to remember that in the OHP plan, you're talking about very often a population under 100% of poverty who has different kinds of resources than those above 100%. Although we serve people under 100 who elect FEOP, but the benefit packages generally are less than the public sector side, especially when you get into dental. The co-pays and the deductibles have been significant especially in the last 6 months to a year. On the private side, they've been increasing pretty substantially.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Could you talk to us a little bit about the dialogue you may have with small employers or employers that are interested in this program and what the level of interest is or maybe what the population of workers in this category might be? What's the market?
Mr. Chair, the dialogue really is occurring on a variety of fronts. When we first started this program, we held a number of focus groups with small employers who initially said, we want to get involved in this, we're really excited. Turns out they weren't really wanting to get involved with this, and they weren't always very excited for a couple of reasons. One is we've had a hard time selling them on the sustainability of the program. Employers have a hard time getting involved in something when they know it's subject to the legislative budgeting process, and they get all their employers really enthused and their employees signed up, and then next year there's no funding, and how do you deal with that? The second is we've been very mindful of their desire to not do a lot of paperwork. What they do not need is the state of Oregon coming down and saying, here's one more piece of paper you need to fill out and give to us. But they have been very cooperative in what we call providing us a certificate of coverage. When somebody enrolls into the program, we ask that the employer fill out a certificate that says, here's the plan, here's the carrier, here's the premium, here's the employee's amount, and that establishes the initial data base that then using their wage stubs that show how much are deducted, we're able to figure out who's covered, how much we should be paying on subsidy, and things like that. In terms of the waiver, the small business community has been just tremendous. Lisa Tressel from AOI and our staff have been working, for example, to try to figure out how we can really reach out to a lot of the small and mid-sized employers in the state who is primarily the dependents. It's primarily the, you know, you talk about restaurants, it's not the waiter. The waiter gets tips. It's the busboy at $6.50 an hour. It's in the ag business. And I'm not talking about so much the migrant population, but in some of the ag firms and processing plants where very often the employee is covered, but the dependents aren't covered because, or they're covered, but there's a premium that's established so high for the dependents that that $7 or $8 an hour individual just can't afford it. But the support from NFIB, AOI, and the small business groups, the agent community, every major insurance carrier in this state, plus two or three of the major foreign carriers, have said they're willing to make FEOP a qualifying event to allow someone to enroll in their program. You know, if you get group coverage, they say when you're employed or 12 months later. The insurance carriers of the state and Aetna and some of the foreign carriers are saying, look, these are people that couldn't get in that first day. They couldn't afford it. So we're willing, at the moment they get the FEOP subsidy, to let them come in. It's called a qualifying event, like death, marriage, or anything else. So the support has really been there. There's something, by the way, on there's a sheet that I think was in the red handout. And on the back of that sheet gives you some hourly wages and family sizes based on the subsidy levels. So, for example, if you're talking to somebody that has a family of three, they can basically make up to, you know, $9 an hour and receive a 75% subsidy level. And that's not a lot of money. That's $1,500 a month. For a family of three, you may pay anywhere from $350 to $700, depending on where you are and what options you have available to you, a month for health insurance. So business likes this because that helps take, I think, you know, a more equitable approach to the lower wage employees being able to provide for their families. I don't know if that answers your question, but
it does. And I suppose in my mind, I'm trying to picture the this particular program, FEOP, and Medicaid programs, and trying to discern the differences between them all. I mean, this seems to me, based on my, I guess my impression, to be a good program to invest money in. You say when it was started, it's gradually been declining in terms of its commitment by the state, from general funds or state funds. Can you give us a little understanding about why that's been the case? Or just, we've had other programs expanding exponentially, but this program gone.
Mr. Chair, as long as you don't have, I mean, every budget session, I tell the great story, and I don't know if I should tell it, but. Now, I remember being called in 1991 to Senator Q-Tub and the co-chairs of Ways and Means, and Senator Timms, and sitting there and saying, we got orders to cut $100 million out of all the programs. We need state general fund dollars, and you're pure state general fund. you know, you're cut. And the only way we get back is people negotiate, not me, but negotiate because they believe in the program. By the way, I did send out travel vouchers and invitations to the 20,000 people on the waiting list, but obviously they didn't come. But that was getting to the financial integrity questions of the program.
So we have 20,000 people now, yesterday, to be on a waiting list.
We have about 130,000 people that are uninsured between 100 and 200% or 170% of federal poverty level. Not all those people are going to buy insurance, whether you provide a subsidy or not. Some of those just choose not to. Secondly, there are those that have assets that would not qualify. They have more than $10,000 in assets. But getting back to your question, the reason it's cut, general fund, and you know, it's been a tough 5 or 6 sessions for the legislature in terms of balancing the budget. And
except that we've expanded other programs. Like, everybody's got their own little center of fun.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rocky, but other programs we've expanded, like the Oregon Health Plan, have had federal match. Your program does not have federal match. It will under the waiver. Is that not correct? So then we can hopefully expand this program with the federal dollars that we will have under the waiver, and probably have a program that will address the sum. I think you said 20,000 on your waiting list now. I mean, you talked about all the others that are eligible, but you do have, I think, in this paperwork where you have 20,000 on the waiting list.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Clinton, I think it's important to note that the big difference between Medicaid and us is they're an entitlement we're not. We can close intake, and Medicaid has not. And there have not been the tools to really reduce. I mean, the promise was reduce benefits, and we can save money and balance the budget. But that didn't come in 93. The waiver, I think, hopefully will provide the legislature with the tools to, through the reduction in benefits if they so choose from the 78% down, to help kind of mitigate some of the expansion there, hopefully. But the big difference is we're not entitlement. You give me $20 million and I get whatever, even with federal match, I still am going to control it to the state dollar. And Medicaid has not had that luxury.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, and thank you for your presentation. I'd like to follow up on one of the agency goals to find out how we're doing. And it's the goal that says that we will expand the participation and representation of minority and underserved populations in the FEOP program. How are we doing, and what is the evidence that tells us how we're doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't think we're doing very well at all. We haven't marketed this program since 1998, so we haven't been out in those communities. The people that we have that we're serving right now really are, to a large degree, people that just walk on the door on their own. So until we know that we can expand the program, we're just not doing very well. Initially, when we first started out the program, I thought we were doing very well and had good representation in non-English speaking, some of the racial minority groups. But since that first year when we said we're not going out the door and telling anybody about the program because we don't have any bucks, we haven't paid a lot of attention to that. Now, I will tell you, we just did an audit and looked at the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the high-risk pool, and where we do provide information and about the program and hopefully get people in that are eligible. And we found we were very unrepresented in the non-English speaking and racial minority groups. Now, OMIP is really a reflection of the private sector market. People get turned down by ODS or Kaiser. They get a letter that says, come to OMIP. So it isn't that we go out and market to people for the first, they hear about us from the first time from us. They hear about it from the carriers. So I think it's more of a reflection of what's happening in the private sector market, that there isn't enough outreach into some of those. OMIP is a part of that. And that report really talked to us about sitting together with our private sector partners to look at that issue. Senator Gordley, I wish I could tell you that we had great representation on all of that, but the fact is we haven't been out marketing and we don't.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to follow up. And let me first say that I really appreciate your forthright response is something that we can hopefully build on. I would just remind our committee that it was in April of 2000 that the Oregon Progress Board released a report which looked at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic groups in Oregon. Have you seen that report, Mr. King?
I have. You've been a part of the task force, the Racial Minority Task Force.
Right.
Kelly Burns has been attending that for a considerable time.
Well, again, speaking to that report, what it revealed is that in several benchmark categories, looking at the years between 1990 and 1996, and we could carry that forward to the present, Oregon's racial and ethnic so-called minority groups lost ground in several benchmark categories, including education, housing, employment, and health care, including access to health care. And we know that the problem that we see here in Oregon around access is also a problem that's reflected nationally as well. Just a few months ago, we had a report out of Harvard University that, again, highlighted the problems that we see with access, and then once people actually get into health care, disparities in treatment. The information that you have provided to us in the document agency overview is helpful, but it doesn't go far enough in the details in the numbers that you've given at the back of the report. You give us the geographic breakdown in age and gender, but again, if we are to monitor our progress in how we are doing or not doing in serving, reaching Oregon's racial and ethnic groups, then we also need to capture those numbers, whatever they are, so that we know, again, what progress we are making or not. So I would like to see the numbers, whatever they are, and I'd like to have those provided to the committee as well.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, we'll provide those numbers to you. We do capture that information in all of our programs. It is, I believe, not a required field. It's voluntary to fill out. But we have that. We've also provided those figures to the task force, and I think, Kelly, we have all that. We can get all those figures for you.
Thank you.
All right, great. Any other questions? I want to take just about a 10-minute break. We'll be back. The Oregon Health Plan to order, and introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll begin.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is George Dunford. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services. To my left is Jerry Fuller, who works with me in the Department of Human Services. He's a Medicaid policy expert, and I thought he would be a handy person to have sitting next to me since this is truly my second full day on the job. I want you to know that. But I want you to take everything I tell you and listen in great earnest, if you don't mind.
I will. Sound like a car salesman I run into.
Actually, right. And I have to also mention to the committee and Mr. Chair that I did spend 10 years at DHS when it was DHR, but it's been 5 years since I've been there. So I can help you with some of the acronyms. I remember a lot of those, and I remember actually quite a bit about the Oregon Health Plan, so I'd be happy to talk to you about that. But I am here to talk to you about cuts at this moment that we will implement starting yesterday at 5.
All right. So I'll go ahead and give us a briefing on those cuts then.
One of the jobs I had at the Department of Administrative Services was statewide budget coordinator. So when DAS drops an administrative rule that reduces the allotments of agencies, I'm acutely aware of that. Our allotment was reduced yesterday at 5 by 5%. That translates into about a $31 million cut for OHP, or OMAP. And let me hold this up so you can see it. You have, I believe, this handout from an earlier session. It has slightly changed because we've repriced a few things and firmed up the dates of implementation now. And so the thing that is different on yours, I believe, if you look at the bottom line of the second page, it should be $30,771,574 general fund. And the reason for that change is...
Sorry, we clarify that again. Second page?
Yeah, second page, it should say 204.
And where
in the total that we are implementing as of yesterday at 5 in cuts for OMAP, the Office of Medical Assistance Program, is $30,771,574 in general fund.
Is that instead of the $22 million? I'm not sure exactly on the form. I'm not sure where you're plugging that information in at.
It's the very last page, the second page, which is the last page of the reductions which do not require statutory change, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I don't think this.
We do not have the same.
I don't think we have the same document.
We are three pages.
You should, Rick, pardon me, Mr. Chair, but you should have the one that says reductions which do not require statutory change.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on page 2,
or 4,
or page 2 of 4, I'm not sure where you're plugging the $30 million figure in.
There should be a subtotal at the bottom.
There is.
Okay.
No.
Would you please pin in, evidently they didn't put that there. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Yeah, top of the
top of the
okay.
Where it's here, I will voice my complaints about your committee staff later.
So noted. So the figure we have is $31,638,981.
Right, and I would like you to change that to $30,771,574.
Okay, 771,574.
Right, and the reason for that change, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I may ask your indulgence, is the last item there, which is I think on yours is probably, let me see. Yeah, it shows $12,020,487.
Okay.
That's the line change. I'd like you to change that to $9,832,072.
Okay.
Other than that, we should be exactly the same.
All right.
And I apologize for that.
That's quite all right.
These were prepared by different folks on different dates. Part of yours, I think, came from the legislative fiscal office, which was based on some earlier information. Okay, getting to those, Scott, that, I have to say that in my 16 years in state government, I've never really been in a position like this where I have actually seen this massive a change to any agency. We have $121 million at the Department of Human Services, which we are implementing, as I say, yesterday at 5 o'clock. In my green eyeshades role, I have to tell you that, to me, that just means we don't have money for programs. And for the OMAP portion, which is what I'm here to testify today on, that translates to about $31 million in cuts. I've grouped those into a couple of different categories. So you're
let me go back again and make sure I understand what you just said. The total reduction across DHR is how much?
$121 million.
$121 million.
Right.
And the OMAP share is roughly $30 million.
Right. And, Mr. Chair, you're fully versed in this, I'm sure, but let me bore you for just a moment with this because it's actually something I know. The reason that we reduce based on these figures at OMAP, for instance, and at FDF and AFS, is that we have line item appropriation from the old one session in our original appropriation bill. So we stick to that. We realize, and I fully realize, that in the next session that will change into a cluster format. So that's the reason for the way this is listed by division.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, can we pull the mic a little bit closer?
Certainly. And for Mr. Chair, Senator George, I apologize for that.
Those mics really don't amplify very much, so.
Do you hear me?
Need to raise your voice. I hear you at personal many times.
No, I've practiced that for many years, Senator Crowell.
Senator Ferriore.
Mr. Chairman, if it hadn't been for those critical remarks about committee staff, maybe the microphones would work.
Senator Ferriore, that'd be something to remember probably about state staff, too.
Senator Gordley.
Right. Mr. Chair, just need a little help down here on the right. What are we looking at? And for what purpose are we looking at this document, Mr. Chair?
Well, I think right now we're just trying to, the environment has changed from the day before yesterday to today, so right now we're just getting a briefing with respect to what some of the reductions are being imposed would mean. So basically it's just background information.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yesterday's presentation prior to 5 would have been potential cuts. With the Office of Medical Assistance Programs today, I'm talking to you about cuts we are actually implementing today.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
Is that a response to the governor's decision that he made yesterday, or
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it is in part, it's in response more to the allotment process of Chapter 291, which requires us to reduce our budget based on the fact that we have 5% less general funds.
Okay,
thank you. As I mentioned earlier, I have grouped these cuts into a couple of different categories. The first one being reducing what is paid to medical providers. And we're talking about physical health here. And we reduce pharmacy reimbursement. We have a formula that we use, and we reduce that, which will save the state about $1.7 million in general funds. We reduce payments to hospitals. And if you look on your, the only thing I'm at a disadvantage, Mr. Chair, and I apologize, is on the sheet that you have, I am not talking about eliminate the outlier payments for DRG hospitals. I have moved from the reduced OHP pharmacy, which is number one on your list, which should be, to, on my list, it's number four.
So we're not working from the same document?
Well, we're working on this, off the same document as far as the text. I think the layout is just slightly different.
All right.
Okay.
So, since ours are not numbered, maybe just give us the first line of the sentence in the paragraph you read.
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chair. I started out with reducing OHP pharmacy reimbursement to average wholesale price minus 17%, and that's a change of 3%. Now it's 14%.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there an impact there on mental health programs? If you could identify as you go through each one of these where there's an impact on mental health, that would be helpful to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordy, I'll be happy to. I'll ask my partner, Gary Fuller, to do that while I'm going off this page. He can look at our large document.
Senator Matthew, thank you. Just a clarification again, too, as you're going through this. With the general fund, each one of these has an implementation date. So do I assume this to read that from January 2003 until June 30, 2003, the general fund savings during that period alone is the 1.7.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that is correct.
Right. And then under on the federal funds, those are the federal funds that we would lose during that same period. Is that what that figure is?
Chair, Senator Metzger, that is correct, yes.
Thank you
for pointing that out. The only thing I wish we had was the total fund column, which I apologize we don't have.
Senator Trope.
And if we read the explanation of the effect, it looks like the payments to pharmacies are going to be reduced. Is that cost shift? Will there be actual reduction in delivery to patients from the pharmacy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, we hope, obviously, that there is no access dilemma that's caused by this. However, we are not naive. We do anticipate that there may be some, yes. Because some pharmacies may choose to not participate.
Pharmacies pick it up.
We don't expect all pharmacies to pick this up, no.
Well, Mr. Chair. So again, you are saying that there may be access problems for clients, which is the statement that's printed here, but we don't know, or if we do, tell us how many clients, or even which clients we're talking about statewide.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I wish I could tell you that information. I really do, but I can't. I don't know.
So there will be unintended consequences that we're just not enthusiastic.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes.
Senator Furlan.
Mr. Chairman, I just was curious about how you arrived at the 17% below average wholesale cost. So I could just know a little about methodology.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carrioli, there's been numerous studies by different public organizations, probably private organizations, showing that AWP, the average wholesale price, isn't actually reflective of what is charged to the different pharmacies, whether it's a mom-and-pop retail or a chain, that I've heard all sorts of percentages, generic drugs.
Excuse me a second. Could we have you identify yourself for the record?
Gary Fuller, Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
There's been numerous studies showing that AWP doesn't reflect the cost to the end pharmacy. Generics, I think I've seen numbers anywhere between 50% and 60% difference. Same with brand drugs. So I believe it was a belief that we could reduce the reimbursement by this 3% given that background without completely eliminating access for our clients, without completely eliminating the ability of mom-and-pop pharmacies or the chain pharmacies for delivering services to our clients.
Madam Chairman, I'm getting Mr. Carioli. So we're just going by gut, is what you're telling me. You know, we have information about the average retail price or average wholesale price, AWP, and that AWP does not account for discounts and rebates. We know that, up to 15%. But it does reflect at least some data about relative purchasing power, chains, large multi-state outlets, and single stores that are owner-operated by a pharmacy. It does average those things?
I would tend to say yes. I don't have the precise details behind this reduction, but just the general background.
Okay. Madam Chairman, if I can continue, we know absolutely that the small rural pharmacies are leaving the Oregon Health Plan, and it is now more difficult to find anyone who, in a rural area, who will actually fill those prescriptions at lower than wholesale. So we're aware of that trend.
I'm not aware of that trend in terms of the study, but I would agree that it's intuitive that would happen, that small pharmacies would be less able to deal with these reductions.
Okay. Madam Chairman, I have a pretty fat portfolio of correspondence from rural pharmacists who now are refusing to fill these prescriptions, period, at below cost. And what that will do and what it has done is that it tends to displace the demand for pharmacological assistance to the areas that have these chain stores. And if a person is not able to get a pharmacy to fill a prescription on the Oregon Health Plan in their rural community, do we send them to the next nearest community, neighboring community that has a pharmacy that does participate? Is that how they get their prescription filled?
Well, we do have a mail order pharmacy contract. I don't know how extensive that is currently being used, but that is an option.
Is there any, have you heard of any program, Madam Chairman, that pays people to travel to a nearby pharmacy
to get
their Oregon Health Plan prescription filled?
Yes, Senator Ferrioli, under the medical assistance programs, the state does have to provide assurance of transportation to necessary medical services. So I wouldn't be surprised if transportation is being covered for some folks in some places at some time to be able to obtain their prescription.
Okay.
I also have heard in Washington State that they, because of the issues created up there, they may be using courier services to deliver drugs into the outlying areas.
I guess that this is a related issue. Have you also heard of pharmacists in the rural areas that are having trouble with copays, getting co-payments that are voluntary from Oregon Health Plan subscribers?
Senator Ferrioli, I have personally not heard that, but I would not be surprised.
Madam Chairman, I guess I'm a little distressed about the disconnect apparently between the people that are experiencing our policy, which is has for some time been a reimbursement level at below the average wholesale price, and we're going to increase it. And the correspondence that I have indicates that the copays are impossible to collect since they're voluntary, and that what's happening is that under the Oregon Health Plan, prescription holders are actually being paid up to $50 a round trip to go to a neighboring community to fill their prescriptions, and that some prescription holders are finding it necessary to go twice a week. I mean, if you had a diabetic situation or one that needed a relatively continuous supply of fresh medicine, that might be justifiable. But I'm wondering if this actuarial isn't more by gut than it is by data or feedback from the market. And it sounds to me, and I hope I'm wrong, that you picked this level of 17% below the average wholesale price on a better data stream than just we think this will be okay. And what I heard you say was, well, we think this will be okay.
Thank you, Senator. Any comment?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferriola, on my comment, I would like to get back to you on this one in writing, if you don't mind. I'd be happy to go back to the office and actually get you the information that would at least answer the question.
And if we're going to do a little research on this and get back, I think that's excellent. I'll be happy to share that with the committee. The question I'd like to add to that is how many rural pharmacies have indicated to Oregon Health Plan that they will no longer fill prescriptions under the Oregon Medical Plan. I think you'll be amazed to find that it's most rural pharmacies are now no longer participants in the Oregon Health Plan.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
You get that information.
Fairly, certainly.
Share it with the committee.
We'll get that back through your committee staff.
And Senator Trill?
Well, if there's a problem of the original distribution based on the formula, then with all these cuts, there's going to be certainly an aggravated problem to see a level of cuts in the federal money that's going on. It's a serious problem.
Okay. You want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are.
The next item on the list, and I've got your list in my list, so I will point out the areas where I'd like you to change your list. And then after this hearing, what I intend to do is go back to the office and provide your committee staff with the latest document that I'm testifying from. The next item is, and it begins on your copy, with do not distribute the safety net clinic funding. There's $1.2 million of that left to be distributed, and the first million was not distributed. It was a reduction taken at the February emergency board. This $1.2 is the remainder, and it will not be distributed. It's part of the reduction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. In the notes, you indicate that the result of this may impose a financial hardship on some clinics with inadequate operating margins. How many clinics fit that category of having inadequate operating margins? Again, I'm looking for consequences of taking this action.
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, I will get you that information along, and I will provide that to committee staff along with Senator Crayola's information.
And along with the information about number of clinics, the projected number of clients who we would fail to serve as a result of those clinics going away.
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, I didn't hear that last portion. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I'll speak up. The total number of clients that would not be served as a result of these clinics going away.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, thank you.
Okay.
The third item starts on your document as change beginning date of health plan eligibility for adults and couples. Currently, what we do is back retroactively pay providers based on the date of application for plans, and I think you've heard that in earlier testimony. What this reduction does is make that date effective on the date the application is actually approved. Now, let me mention to you, too, that in your document, it shows $1,663,369. We'd like you to change that to $2,984,377.
Why is there such a significant change there?
Madam Chair, Senator Trill, there's lots of repricing that goes on in this sort of thing and lots of double checking. And frankly, this was an error that was caught. And we updated it. So I want you to have that information. The next item on your list is eliminate outlier payment for DRG hospitals.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Before we go to that next item, again, would you talk about the impact on mental health services?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, certainly.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, according to our look at this, some mental health clients who would be able to get OHP eligibility under the current system, the pay stamp of the application, would not be eligible until later. There may be some cost shift to local hospitals, local crisis centers as a result of that. A lot of it would depend on how long we're in the hospital and how quickly the application could be processed. But bottom line, mental health services will probably be unfunded to some degree for persons in these crisis kinds of interventions.
And if I may follow up on that, then it's possible then that this could result in persons in our communities around the state not being able to find crisis services, that is, mental health treatment services, who could possibly wind up in other circumstances. We currently house a lot of mental health, we house a lot of folks who need mental health treatment in our jail. Could that be an unintended consequence of not providing this funding?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that could be expected, yes. Could confound that problem.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Yeah, Senator Gordley, you started on this thinking and your words on cost shifting as well. So my question becomes, with the increased cost, I'm quoting out of the dialogue here, increased cost for clients which meets criteria for civil commitment, that plus what I would see as cost shift when these 120,000 eligibles or the percentage of them that are coming on don't get services right away, but that would be delayed a month, some of them would end up in emergency rooms. There'd be cost shifting there, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I believe that would be correct.
Has there been any calculation of how much all the cost shifting would cost at the one end and what the actual savings would be once you were able to subtract the cost shiftings from the figure you have as savings? Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I believe I followed your question, and I would speculate that the savings that we've listed here, total fund, whatever that might be, would represent the cost shift to hospital providers or other providers who will see these folks without a payer of resort.
It would represent?
Would represent a cost shift to the different kinds of providers, hospitals, perhaps a mental health clinic, perhaps a substance abuse clinic. It would represent a cost shift to those providers.
But what I'm saying is, if you were able to come up with a dollar figure for the cost shift, and I've highlighted stuff in both the left and right columns, would we end up saving any money? I mean, it's 2.9 technically saved, but we're not saving it. But we're not saving all that when you've got a cost shift. I mean, yeah, the state's saving it. I guess the private sector, the hospitals, et cetera, are picking it up. Is that what?
You said it represents it, and I was wondering if you're saying it's kind of a wash.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, without doing some research, I would suggest that it's a wash. It's wash your through the private side. If you wish, we can see if there's any information to quantify that.
My guess is it might mean that a whole lot of people who need to be served just aren't served until they qualify, and they just delay going to get treatment.
Madam Chair, Senator Crowe, that could be the outcome also, except for those emergency instances where they will be seen.
I think what the committee is just now receiving, Mr. Dunford, is a practice copy or copy with the changes that you want us to be aware of. So we can use that instead of the other document you gave us, correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your indulgence and the committee's indulgence. I appreciate that. And now we can talk off of the same document. And let me correct the record also, if I'm right. On item number three, which is the item number three in both our copies, with respect to eligibility, I misstated. And what I want to say to you is, first, under the federal funds, in the document you originally had, we had no federal funds showing there. Mm-hmm. And in the document you were just handed and that I'm testifying from, you'll see the federal funds loss there is $4,413,681. I want the record to reflect that. And also, eligibility is actually not the date that we approve it. It's the date on the first of the month following that request being made and approval being granted. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
So that implies it could be as much as 6 or 7 weeks.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, depending on the date of the request, yes.
Okay. If you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item on your sheet is the eliminated outlier payments for DRG hospitals and reduce the DRG unit value. The general fund savings estimated by DHS is $3,375,000 in general fund and the loss of $4,991,386 in federal funds. And the impact on the right hand side, you'll see the impact. And generally, we try to clearly state that for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Again, is there a list that would tell us which hospitals are operating with that inadequate operating margin so that we have an idea of where those, where closures might take place? Or not just closures, but, you know, impact on services.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will attempt to provide that information.
The next item, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is the elimination of the remainder of the mental health and alcohol and drug portions of the Oregon Children's Plan. You'll see that we've tried to clearly state that we estimate that this will impact 500 clients. And we implement that on December 1st. That will save the department $2,600,000 in general fund. Again, we have tried to clearly state the impact on the right-hand side of your document.
This is a kind of program that's really preventive, isn't it? A subsequent really very extensive health problems in the future. You know, if we eliminate this, aren't we likely to see tremendously increased costs down the road?
Madam Chair, Senator Crow, this is a program that was added during the last legislative session. I believe it was priced originally at 11 or 12 million, something like that. The current budget has $5.5 million. This is the remainder for the rest of the biennium.
These are children and families that aren't eligible for medical assistance or CHIP. These are services, probably the only services that that would be getting at this point. So it may, it is perceived as a preventive program, and without it, there may be very limited or no access otherwise for these families.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordon?
Just for a clarification, you said that these are families and children who are not eligible for CHIP?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, generally these families are not, these children are not eligible for CHIP. These are the uninsured folks, although some could be. I mean, I believe the guidelines that have been put together are not completely either or.
Okay.
There could be some minor overlap.
Is it accurate to say these are the poorest of the poor, the most vulnerable families and children?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the families that are being accessing the children's plan are perhaps not the poorest of the poor, but they're certainly not the affluent families that, that could afford or might have private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
The Oregon Health Plan groups, the children eligible for CHIP definitely meet that classification, if you will, of the poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm. Some of these children may be eligible for those programs. Their incomes may be a little higher. They may have resources or something else or citizenship to preclude them from the Oregon Health Plan or CHIP.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the next item on your list is reduction in the Oregon Health Plan eligibility for what we call our PLM program for pregnant women and children. We've moved that down to save $953,623 in general fund and $1.4 million in federal funds. That has moved down from 170% of federal poverty level, or FPL, to 133% of the federal poverty level.
So, since math is not my forte, that is a loss of what match?
At the loss, Madam Chair, of $1
million. So, I mean, is 70-30 or?
Madam Chair, that should be the Medicaid match, approximately 60-40.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that it's important to put the impact on the record. I know the words are here in print, but I'd like to hear them out loud, because I think that the impact is just really, it's just so terrible. Please.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this will impact, we estimate, 2,500 of our clients, of your clients.
Pregnant women and children.
Yes, Senator Gordley, and if I might add in editorial fashion, yes, it is a tragic reduction. We don't have a lot of options here.
Pregnant women and children will lose ready access to health care. They may show up in emergency rooms or safety net clinics with more severe health issues. A lack of prenatal care can result in increased health problems for the mom and the newborn child.
Well, we just reduced the number of safety net clinics, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. Okay, continue, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. The next item you'll see on your list is the elimination of the CHIP Children's Health Insurance Program. This will impact, we estimate, 20,000 children in the state. And this is to save approximately $1.2 million in general funds and slightly over $3 million, almost $3.1 million in federal funds.
Is that likely to continue into the next biennium? It is?
Madam Chair, Senator Curl, I don't know that answer. I'll be happy to get that for you once it's known. Certainly, we wouldn't like to see that happen, but again, that might be something outside of our control based on the budgetary constraints we operate under.
Well, again, Madam Chair, looking at this reduction to the CHIP program, again, we're talking about children.
And again, the impact, reading the note, without ready access to health care may result in decreased immunization rates, school attendance issues, sicker children seeking treatment from emergency rooms and public clinics. The direction that we're heading with these reductions is just so uncivilized that I'm heartsick. I am. Please continue.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, thank you. The next item before you on our reduction menu here is the elimination of the medically needy program. That affects approximately 8,400 of our clients, your clients. They are all elderly or disabled. That will save the department and the state $6.9 million in general fund and over $10 million in federal match.
Be anything less of the health fund when we make all these cuts for the rest of this year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troy, yes, the health plan will still be in place in the state. Obviously, reduced by $31 million and reduced by the, as Senator Gordley has pointed out, tragedies program reduction.
Mr. Chair, I also see a statement here that doesn't make sense to me. In the impact note, the last sentence says that there also exists the possibility of increased mental health services as the lack of sustaining medication could generate psychiatric issues that would require hospitalization. Hospitalization where?
Chair and Senator Gordley, the medically needy program in its current configuration serving aged and disabled only provide medication, mental health treatment, alcohol and drug treatment, and some transportation through those services. What this is saying, without those medications, if they're unable to afford them or get coverage through the medically needy program, that they may decompensate and end up in the emergency room or coming to the attention of the Justice Department, the justice system.
Well, actually, what this says is that if that were to happen, that this would require hospitalization. And again, my question is, hospitalization where? What community that we know of in the state has hospitalization available for people who are going to fall through this crack?
Chair and Senator Gordley, it's another one of the tragedies that we've discussed here today. They may get emergency room treatment and some brief medication through the hospital, but the system is overloaded.
Let me ask a question. With all of these reductions, how many layoffs are you going to have?
Mr. Chair, very good question. And I have to say that, don't forget, almost all of this relates to provider payments. There's very little staffing involved in this. We cut about 44,000 checks a month. We send out about $183 million a month. Mm-hmm. And those go to providers, local communities, counties. And although I'm sure I'll be hammered for saying this, I'll say it to you anyway. I'm an old economics major from Willamette, and I have to think that my professor would say that the multiplier effect of being a Keynesian would be at least 4 to 1. So these cuts here, they have to multiply times 4 because the impact is directly on the community, not to mention the impact of folks that have nowhere to go.
All right, and
by the way, to directly answer your question, because we aren't involved in the service provision necessarily, other than the administrative task of cutting checks, verifying the applications, making sure that providers are providing quality service, unlike a child protective service program or adult and family services program, that staff is not giving direct service. We are eligibility determination people in this.
So would the answer be there wouldn't be any layoff?
I would, Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. Not in this program.
right, thank you.
And maybe some administrative layoffs resulting from fewer checks being written, but no direct service.
All right, thank you. Senator Shields.
I understand that there aren't layoffs here, but given that you write checks and you do reviews of the programs that you're writing checks for, what do you project layoffs to be in all of those providers out there? I mean, don't you have some feeling for that? I'm just wondering, because we know there'll be layoffs. It's just that they're not your layoffs.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, thank you. I'd like to comment on that, but I wasn't asked that question. So in terms of state layoffs, I would say probably minimal with respect to OMAP. In terms of provider layoffs, I would hesitate to hazard a guess, but it would be substantial. Because these are small providers. I mean, if ever there were a mom-and-pop kind of business, I mean, this is it.
Right. And that's where you get some of that multiplier effect, I assume.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I guess I need to go back to the question about the accountability in the prescription program. We heard testimony over the last several days in the committee that the prescription program is a significant portion of the Oregon Health Plan, and that as a result of the Secretary of State's audit, which points up the fact that there really isn't any federal requirement for accountability, and only a recent direction within the agency within the last 3 months to put in an accountability program for prescription drugs, which is not yet in place. How is it that you can determine a level of reduction, or even whether or not those dollars are being expended appropriately? I mean, the feedback is that we don't have an accountability system in place for prescriptions. It's been acknowledged by the agency. It's been pointed out by the Secretary of State in the audit. So I guess I'm confused about how it is that you can, without having that accountability system, have an actuarial that is of any value in management direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, thank you for that question. I appreciate it. I don't agree with the lack of accountability, so I'm the wrong person to talk to about that. I've read the audit. I understand it. I was a tax lawyer for many years. This is a big program. There's lots of money spent in it. Could we do a better job? I would never argue that we're doing the best job we can. Will we do a better job? Certainly we would like to, yes. And if you have a specific question or I give you a specific answer, I'll be happy to.
Mr. Chairman, I'm gratified that there's a disagreement. I think disagreement is healthy, but the agency doesn't disagree. The agency agrees with the audit. There is no, has been no, and currently does not exist in the system, a feedback mechanism that correlates prescriptions with encounter data with medical charting. And those are absolutely critical elements to make an actuarial. Yet we're going to cut the actuarial, we're going to cut the reimbursement rate, and I'm not even certain that I could look constituents in the eye and tell them that there's an accountability model within the agency that's comprehensible. And I certainly couldn't tell them that as far as prescription drugs are concerned, that we have a good model for the actuarial. So I guess I'm going to ask you the direct question. On what basis are you setting the actuarials for prescription reimbursement? If you don't have a system, the Secretary of State says you don't have a system. The agency agrees that you don't have a system. They're in the process of building an accountability system. What do you base your disagreement on? And what are you using to set the actuarial for prescription reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, thank you again for that question. I base my comment and my general answer to your general question on my belief in working at DHS for 10 years that people do a good job there. They work hard there. And I wouldn't disagree with you, as you earlier stated, that we have some issues to deal with. We will deal with them. But again, I'm asking you, if you have a question, if you want me to get an answer for you in terms of how we actually determine prescription drug reimbursement rate, I will do that for you.
Mr. Chairman, I think that was exactly the point of the question, and I thought it was pretty specific. And I just believe that in the clear indications of an absence of any sort of encounter data, feedback data, I don't know how you could set an actual rail or how you could justify modifying. So I'm anxious to have that information, and I appreciate the willingness of the witness to get it.
There does seem to be some disparity between what the agency says, the audit says, and what you're generally representing here today, so at least it's somewhat of a quandary trying to figure out what is accurate and what is not. I mean, I hear you saying that the folks that work in DHS are generally good workers, they're hard workers, they try to do a good job, so on and so forth, generally representing some pride in the organization. That, at least that's what I think I hear you saying, correct? And you're not saying that you have a perfect system that probably needs some help, correct? Yes, no, maybe. Help us understand. That's one of the reasons for having you here.
Sure.
Generally, let's say, what are the systems in place?
I'll be happy to help you, Mr. Chair, if I can.
Sure.
I will be happy to get the committee, Senator Ferriero in particular, the answer to the question. And I want to just say that the general, I think, rubric behind the question is what I was dealing with more than the specific answer. And when I say that to you, I'm not trying to be coy or trying to sidestep the issue. What I want you to know is no one at DHS purposely screws up on things. And I want to make sure people understand that, because I've been in the private sector for a long time and worked with mostly corporate entities. So I understand the accountability issue well. I also understand the accountability issue with respect to what we do with the department. And I want to assure you that not only do you get the answer, we will always strive to do a very good job. But again, the issue isn't that people are purposely trying not to be accountable, I guess, is what I'm talking to you about.
Right.
We want to be accountable.
Oh, and we're not trying to ascribe, and I don't think Senator Ferriero is attempting to ascribe any evil intent or any of that nature. I think that what we're a little concerned about, or I guess in fog about, is what system does exist. We were told that there are virtually no controls for prescription medication, cost accounting, or whatever it is, and so now you're telling us there is, and so now we're kind of wondering what it is.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not suggesting that we control the pharmaceutical companies. Please don't.
I'm not talking about I'm talking about how this agency spends its money and how it accounts for various medications that are paid for, reimbursed. I mean, one of the questions is, do you determine whether or not prescription medications that are paid for are above or below the line? Do they fit in the American Health Plan in terms of the prioritized list, or is there any mechanism that would determine that? From what my understanding is, there isn't such a thing, because the physicians don't know necessarily what that prescription is for as it relates to a diagnosis. Am I making any sense? I may not. You guys understand this a lot better.
You're making perfect sense, and I will answer the question in writing.
Mr. Chairman, whether or not our state employees in the Department of Human Services or those of that administer their health plan are diligent and well-intentioned is not at all at the issue here. I believe absolutely that they are. But I also believe that there may be a corporate culture in the Oregon Health Plan, because it's a new program and because it's a cutting-edge program, maybe the first of its kind in the U.S., where many of the folks that are in the program, especially given the governor's attention to this program, that are on sort of the psychological ramparts, that they view any question about this program as a threat to the existence of the program, and they circle the wagon. This agency has not been forthcoming with information. And that corporate culture needs to change. I have a strong sense that because this program leverages a lot of federal dollars, that the people working in the program look at it as a way to import dollars into the state of Oregon and provide health care services that wouldn't ordinarily be available. And that is about as noble a purpose as you'll find. But the question about accountability
And the question about what the appropriateness and the methodology of rate setting and reimbursements and capitation affect every citizen and every service provider and every hospital and every clinic. And I have a tendency to think that people are looking at the broad picture and treating unequals equally. The hospitals and the clinics and the pharmacists in rural areas are at risk. And they are part of the healthcare continuum for two-thirds of the land mass with only a third of the citizens. And the way we capitate and the way we reimburse and the methodologies that we use and the accountability of the citizens have to be transparent. And it isn't. It isn't closed. It's deficient. It doesn't meet federal standards. And it doesn't meet the basic test of whether an ordinary citizen can figure out that there's logic and reason here. So it isn't about the attitude of folks in the agency or the altruism of the purpose. None of those things are at question. Nobody, I don't think anybody's purposely obfuscating for any sinister reason. But I can't tell how you do things. And certainly other folks that don't have the access to information that we have also can't tell. But I have to talk to the owners of Murray Drugs, who has a little three pharmacy chain in Eastern Oregon, who cannot now participate in the Oregon Health Plan because of the low rate of capitation and the under reimbursement. And when they complain about that and try to get that grievance addressed, the next thing that they hear about is that we're paying people round trip expenses to drive to the nearest Fred Meyer store, which is a $50 round trip expense, and so in fact we are subsidizing the bankruptcy of rural pharmacies by our policy, and it doesn't make sense. It'd be better to work on the capitation rate and make it more fair, or maybe provide a differential for those that are small and remote, like we do with schools, like we do with educational service districts, like we do. I mean, we're subsidizing physicians in rural communities with a $5,000 a year tax credit. And we're essentially paying to bankrupt pharmacy. And I want to know who's thinking about that picture. And I'm sure from the broader perspective, from a 30,000-foot perspective, 17% below pharmacy costs makes perfect sense for Rite Aid because they can last leader their prescription. And, so, and for Fred Meyers and for Costco and for anybody on the internet and for all the generic companies, but it certainly doesn't make any sense for the one-person pharmacy in John Day or Condon or some of the other places where people rely, where I have an elderly population that's more Medicaid, more Medicare, more elderly, more dependent, and less able and less mobile. So I guess what I'm trying to get across here is it's not just that I think that there's chests of money buried within the agency that are not being appropriately spent. I can't tell you that there isn't, but I can tell you that we're losing pharmacy practitioners because of our policy. And so I want to be able to know with absolute certainty that capitation rates are sensibly based, that they're transparent, and that ordinary citizens can look at the information and see the logic in it. And until that happens, you're going to have a lot of people questioning whether or not the folks that are originators of the Oregon Health Plan are just still on their ramparts and still see every question as a threat to the existence of the Oregon Health Plan and still feel that sharing information is a negative, not a positive. And so there's sort of my take on this capitation question on prescription. I need more information.
Well, and I think,
Mr. Chair, Senator Fraley, you may take a moment to respond.
Well, hang on just a minute. I want to say that it's my opinion that the legislature should be pointing fingers at itself for not spending the time, effort, and energy to hold the agency accountable. I don't mean that in a negative way, but I mean putting the right kind of controls in place and spending the time to make sure that the right kind of cost control mechanisms, accounting mechanisms, reports back to the legislature, et cetera, were in place a long time ago. This has been a program since 1989 inception. But I think it was pointed out in an earlier meeting, the problem with the Oregon Health Plan and the waivers is you have a waiver from federal requirements for the most part, and we don't do much here to really get into the need of what the Oregon Health Plan is, or even the Medicaid plan. And I think that the legislature needs to spend more time there, again, not necessarily for the purpose of destroying a program or ascribing blame to any one group of individual. I think we need to spend more time doing this as a matter of public policy because, again, in the last 10 or 11 years, the whole environment regarding health care has changed not only in Oregon but nationally. And we've got some huge problems on the horizon, whether we're talking about the mental health system, whether we're talking about providing medical care to individuals without resources. It's something the legislature, I think, has simply said, it's a good thing to do, go do it. But now the chickens are coming home to roost because the budget is not sustainable in its current form. And politically, when we compete with the Oregon Health Plan compared to education, compared to prisons, corrections, et cetera, it's not sustainable. So somebody, some of us are going to get stuck with, some, hopefully some future legislature, is going to get stuck with having to make one of those difficult choices. Kind of what we're here in the fifth special session trying to figure out. It's not easy. Anyway, now you can respond. I've got a little speech out of the way. I feel better.
You are the chair, Mr. Chair, and I respect that.
That's why I take the prerogative. It's kind of fun.
And I also want to say through you, Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, that assuming term limits doesn't kick back in, I will make it my life's work, and I'm serious about this, to help you understand how we compute the cap rates for every part of the Oregon Health Plan. I say that not so much to tongue-in-cheek, but I just want you to know that I'm not on the ramparts or any other part of the castle trying to defend the health plan. I want you to have the information, and you should have it.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions, concerns, speeches, or other dissertations? Senator Shields, you got one?
Well, I'll make my sermon short, okay? And that is to simply say that I appreciate how forthright you've been in sharing with us. And I think Senator Ferrioli made a very good point. I mean, everybody looks at me as a legislator from Portland, but I spent 4 years down in Chiloquin and in Fort Glamis and know what some of those small communities are about early in my career. And so I understand that perspective, and it's quite often a big plan has to look at the big picture, and sometimes there are blind spots in it. And so I appreciate the way Senator Ferrioli was able to clarify what some of his concerns are, because frankly, up until now, I wasn't as clear about them myself as he made them in this last attempt at it. Thank you.
All right. I think at this point, Senator Nestor, appreciate the fact that you've been calling. You've heard a lot of this material before, so you can comment and listen to it over and over again. If there are issues the committee would like to delve into in greater detail, appreciate your suggestions or your ideas where you would like to go. I think at this juncture, I'm tired, and my brain is turning to mush, and there's too much going on, I think, in this building from my perspective right now to deal adequately with the situation. So I think we're going to go ahead and adjourn if that's okay with you. And
but you mean I can actually object to that, Mr. Chair? Or?
Sure, I've it's been so nice, and really, I do. I appreciate, like Senator Gordon, I do appreciate the animated approach in your presentation to this committee, because I think it's helpful that we don't have to, I mean, you're tough, but, you know, we don't have to necessarily draw everything out of you, per se. So, Senator Trump.
Earlier today in the press conference, you and other legislators had, you made the statement that the current waiver, I guess, request is on hold. I just wanted to do one of the fellowship meant by that, because I didn't.
Well, what I meant by that was that the federal government has placed the current waiver application on hold. That is the extent of my knowledge.
How do you know that? Because nobody else seems to know that.
Well, I will keep my sources to myself present, but you can call Mr. Scully's office in Washington, D.C. and verify it here if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, this is new information that was not shared with us a few days ago.
It's new information as of yesterday afternoon.
Okay. I have a quick question. Did I fall asleep here for a minute? Did we not do page 3, or we just kind of, I mean, we went through 2 of these pages.
So did we miss that one?
Yes, we missed it.
Do we want
to cover it all? I would like to spend a few minutes. I had a couple questions about the third page. I was reading ahead, and I don't know if you want to just quickly go through the ones and then the questions will come up in order or what. Seems to me that doing 2 out of 3.
That's fine, good.
Mr. Chair, you have rejuvenated yourself.
I have. I'm suddenly
happy to
say about
this. Thank you, Senator Shields. I appreciate it. I am prepared to talk about reductions which require statutory change, but I have to tell you that that is not part of our reduction option list that will be part of the allotment reduction. So this is purely speculative on my part, and I would appreciate it maybe if you had alleged counsel discuss this with you more. Because although I'd love to give you legal advice, it's probably not appropriate.
Are you an attorney?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Are you insured for that?
Mr. Chair, I am a government attorney, and therefore I do not carry insurance because you have deigned to protect me.
Wait a minute. I'm confused. I'm talking about item number 9, and then 1, 2, and 3 on the third of 15 pages. I mean, we were talking a few seconds ago about eliminating the medically needy program with its 8,400 clients, but if you flip the page over, you end up with... I see. Is this somebody else's bailiwick? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, you're Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, you're referring to the 15-page document. That's the entire reduction list that the Department of Human Resources at 5 o'clock is implementing.
But you happen to have stapled together and handed to us a minute ago 3 pages of it. Okay.
The last 3 are not relevant to this.
And no, what we just did was pages 1 of 15 and 2 of 15, and why is this one stapled on if it's not part of your report? I don't understand.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, there might be a bit of an administrative question here. We handed out a 4-page document to you that is our latest.
They got, because you were correcting my number, I got the selected one. Those 3 pages are 15. And because it's less per page, or excuse me, per item per page, it still has less than the 3.
If the chair would indulge me, we can talk about number 9. What's listed as number 9, that's fine.
Well, it's only a $25 million item when you add up general fund and federal funds. That's why I kind of wanted...
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, thank you. It is a $25 million item. It is the moving of the line from 566 to 517. And that will generate about $9.8 million in savings on general fund column and about $14.5 million in the federal fund column. And because we would have to have federal approval for that change, we estimate the implementation date to be January 1 of 2003. And I might, if I can ask the committee's indulgence for one more point, if you look on the right side of that, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, you'll see the impact. I'm not really versed in many of the medical procedures, so I won't try to read those and pronounce those to you, but they're clearly listed there for you.
And then,
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, yes, that is my understanding.
Could you provide for us the entire 15-page document?
Certainly, Senator Chair, if you give me a few minutes, I'll be happy to go back to the office and get it for you. I'm happy to adjourn.
You could give it to Rick, and then he can distribute it to the rest of us so I have a chance to look at this.
Sure.
Any other question?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordon?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank Rick Verkopian for the draft background brief on mental health and chemical dependency treatment. It's going to be very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Great.
Thank you for indulging me.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to be adjourned for today.
Thank you.